Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, marking 47 years of commitment to operating the Trans-Alaska Oil Pipeline. Learn more at alyeskapipeline.com.
A new federal-state effort to stem the flow of illegal drugs and ramp up the punishment for those who sell them is underway across the nation, including in Alaska. Will it cut the high rates of overdose here? What else are the state's top legal officers focused on? Alaska's Attorney General and the state's U.S. Attorney join us today on Talk of Alaska.
The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters.
Hello, from Alaska Public Media, it's Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. Alaska has long been an addled state, at or near the top in the nation for high rates of alcoholism, high rates of drug abuse, high rates of overdose. That dysfunction generates many other forms of crime, theft, violence, sexual assault, child neglect and abuse. Alaska is a tough state to police for drugs and substance abuse problems. Many communities have little or no local police presence. Distance, extreme weather, and winter darkness complicate law enforcement from afar, and an extremely lucrative market for illegal opioids make it an appealing target for those who sell drugs. The federal government started a campaign this spring called Operation Take Back America. The initiative aims to curtail illegal border crossing, cartels, and the trafficking of drugs and human beings. So what does this crackdown look like in Alaska? Here to describe how state and federal enforcement are working in tandem to tamp down the flow of drugs to Alaska is Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor and the U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning, and thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much for being in studio. It's great to have guests live with me. So this is the first time to have both of you on Talk of Alaska. I'm so happy to have you in the studio with me. Attorney Heyman, you're relatively new to Alaska and your position. Before we discuss the campaign, tell us where you're from and what you did before this.
Sure. I was originally practicing in Southern California. I was in private practice doing commercial litigation, some defense work for about a dozen years. And then I went to the U.S. Attorney's Office in the Southern District of California, which is San Diego. I was there for about 8 years, and then I went overseas working at a couple of U.S. embassies. One was in Kathmandu, Nepal, and then Colombo, Sri Lanka, working in the Maldives. A lot of human trafficking, opiates as well, heroin coming from Western Nepal that were making its way back to the United States. Then when COVID hit, the whole world changed, of course. And I ended up coming to Alaska in 2020, so I've been here for about 5 years. Since that time, I've been...
you're not relatively new to Alaska, then. Well, for some reason, I thought you'd only been here for about a year, so excuse me.
No, that's okay. And since that time, I've been handling a variety of cases, you know, focused on specifically Alaska issues, a lot of rural Alaska issues. For instance, I handled the Jessica Spade overdose death case with the opioids, and then I've been in this position since February. So I've been in the trenches for a number of years at the U.S. Attorney's Office.
But relatively new to the U.S. Attorney's Office here in Alaska. And are you still waiting on Senate confirmation in that position?
So the appointment process can actually go one of two ways. And that is one option. The other option is to become the U.S. Attorney through judge order. And about 2 weeks ago, the judges of the district did enter an order appointing me the U.S. Attorney. And so I will be in this position until such time as the president decides to nominate me or someone else and have them confirmed by the Senate.
I see. Okay, thank you. Thanks for getting us started. Attorney General Taylor, Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau were designated as high-intensity drug trafficking areas, or HIDA, in 2018. This designation comes from the Office of National Drug Control Policy. Does this bring extra tools to the fight against illegal opioids, or what does it do beyond a label?
Yeah, no, this initiative is extremely important for Alaskans and extremely effective to date. Basically, what it does is it brings extra tools to the fight, but it also allows the coordination better between, federal government, state, local government. And so there's about 22 local, state, and federal agencies involved in HIDTA. And so that allows for us to communicate more effectively, to really target areas that are being affected. It's a force multiplier, really, for us, where you have state troopers that, normally our referrals come from state troopers or local law enforcement. Now we have all those entities working together in a cohesive manner. It really does increase the effectiveness of those. And it's been quite successful. I don't know if Michael wants to talk about some of the successes that we've had, but I mean, there's been some big drug busts as a result of that initiative.
Well, and we'll drill down a bit on those, but I want to stay with you for just a moment, sir. The Take Back America is a federal campaign. So talk about the resources, and then Mr. Heyman, if you would pick it up from there, the resources that it brings to Alaska and what the Attorney General's role is in this.
Yeah, I think U.S. Attorney Michael Heyman would have to talk a little bit about what the resources are involved in that.
Sure.
We're involved tangentially in that we support what the federal government's doing in, the Take Back America focuses on illegal immigration. It focuses on cartels. It focuses on foreign gangs. So all of those areas where we see an uptick in crime in our state that flow from those entities. So the cartels, obviously, drug trafficking, human trafficking at times, foreign gangs, the same thing, involved in the drug trade, involved in organized retail crime. These initiatives that the federal government focus on have a trickle-down effect to the state. For certain. And as we work more closely together, obviously we can coordinate on those types of issues as well.
Mr. Heyman, pick it up there. The effort to take America back, from whom? Is there one target here or multiple targets?
There are multiple targets. And if I can take a step back just a second to describe what Operation Take Back America is, because, in some respects, one could look at it and say it's just a new label for something that's been going on, but that's not really the case. It is truly a new initiative that the Department of Justice has put in place. And what it is it's a nationwide initiative to stop the flow of illegal immigration, and then, most importantly for Alaska, to address transnational crime. And that transnational crime piece breaks down then into a couple of different categories, which is violent crime that's associated with the transnational organizations and the drug trafficking. And so what we're doing is, with this new initiative, it's a marshaling of assets, as Attorney General said, that we've not ever seen before. It's a laser focus that we've not ever seen before to address these issues.
So talk about those overlapping jurisdictions and how Alaskans should understand that. Federal law applies to some drug cases. Others are prosecuted by the state as alleged violations of state law. Help clarify where those lines are and how you work together to sort of leverage more legal weight when needed to prosecute.
Sometimes these lines are not easily distinguishable. There is a lot of overlapping jurisdiction between the two, but that's one of the great reasons that the two of us are sitting at this table even today, is to make sure that we're maximizing our efficiencies and our efforts to address these issues. But first, it comes with looking at if something is truly a federal crime, if something is truly a state crime, or whether we're in the middle there. And so I'll give some examples. When you have, for instance, a murder case, typically that's going to be something that we would address on the state side. When you have something that's a terrorism case, that's going to be something that would be addressed on the federal side. But then we start to talk about what's in the middle there, and that's where a lot of the issues in Alaska come into play. For instance, drug trafficking. Oftentimes that can be prosecuted both at the state level and both at the federal level. And what we'll do is our officers will sit down and we'll look at a particular crime and we'll say, okay, what resources does the federal government have to bear on it, to bring to an issue? We'll look at what the potential sentencing is, whether the federal government, you could get a better sentence on the federal side. And so there's a lot of considerations on those cases in the middle there that the two offices will sit down, will hash out to figure out what the best approach is in a particular case.
And in January, President Trump issued an executive order that designated cartels as terrorist organizations. What does this change, and how is it adding to your arsenal for fighting drug crimes? Are you bringing charges of terrorism against drug dealers?
We have not seen a terrorism charge in Alaska yet. That's not to say that couldn't happen. And what we are trying to do is by working with the Attorney General's offices, we take cases that, you know, if you arrest drugs on the street, there's a somebody pulls over a car, for instance, and they find narcotics in there in big weights. On one hand, that could be prosecuted to the state as a possession or a distribution case. On the other hand, we can look at it from the federal side and say, wait a minute, this person is just a part of a larger organization. We will try to figure out that organization. And so with the Operation Take Back America, we're now connected closely with our counterparts in Seattle, our counterparts in San Diego even, to figure out whether that person that the state has just arrested, the troopers have arrested on the streets of Anchorage, has made phone calls to somebody in Southern California, and whether that's tied to a cartel or other organization. And so we're trying to build those cases that are much broader than just the simple distribution case within Alaska.
Yeah, Lori, if I could jump in there and just add to that, you know, the designation of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations is an important another aspect because I believe it'll reduce the drugs that are entering Alaska, right? Because what Michael was talking about are once the drugs are in Alaska, what is our responsibilities to it? But I believe that designation will prevent a lot of those drugs from even hitting our state because of the extra tools that federal law enforcement has, you know, for example, freezing cartel assets, denying entry from people in the southern border or wherever they're crossing. Those types of things are all tools that will help reduce the amount of drugs that we're dealing with in the state.
And so it's that cross-border that when there's crimes that are happening in multiple states or alleged activity happening in multiple states, that's really when the weight of the federal government can come into play layered with the state. Is that correct?
Absolutely, because anytime narcotics is flowing to Alaska, I can guarantee you that there's also narcotics in that organization that are flowing to other parts of the country. And if we're just looking at things in a tunnel and we only see one piece of it, we're not understanding the entire organization. And that's our goal, is to not just look at things with tunnel vision, but is to understand the complexity and international scope of what the cartels are doing.
Yeah, and the level of cooperation between the U.S. Attorney's Office and my office is so important because we're all both strapped for resources. We both have to make resource decisions when we charge cases. Do we have enough resources to charge this case, or do you know? And so, if we're both charging the same case and we aren't talking to each other, that's just a waste of government resources that could be used to charging another individual, you get the idea of that, right? So, it's the better we communicate, the better we are able to crack down on these issues that we're seeing in Alaska.
All right, if you're just joining us, this is Talk of Alaska, and today we're talking about the federal Take America Back anti-drug campaign that the state is also working with U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman, and Treg Taylor, the Alaska Attorney General, are working together on this campaign to stop or at least try to stem the flow of drugs into Alaska, illegal drugs. Attorney General Taylor, you had said in a previous interview that your priorities shift, of course, based on what's happening in the state. But describe some of your current focus. You mentioned sexual assault and domestic violence, a perennial and certainly large issue problem in our state. How are you working to lower those rates?
Yeah, no, Lori, you're absolutely right. Our focus does sort of shift from time to time. One of the big benefits of the way that Alaska has the system set up is that all the prosecution on the state level occurs through the office, right, the Department of Law. So within that, we have 150 prosecutors dedicated to protecting Alaskans. And so we don't have elected DAs like you see in the lower 48. And so when you hear the term DA in Alaska, those DAs work for the Department of Law. And so what we're able to do is we see the whole picture. We can address issues as they're coming up pretty effectively because there's a single voice that's sort of directing that traffic, and that's the Attorney General. And our priority, I think, is multifaceted right now, because if you look at crime, I mean, it's all interrelated. There's a lot of overlap. So obviously we're focused on sex assault and domestic violence because we lead that nation. That's we lead the nation in that statistic, and that's not a good thing, right? We're number one, and that's a bad thing.
Yes.
And so obviously that's been a very big focus of our office in trying to alleviate that and to prosecute those that commit those crimes. But on the other hand, a lot of that is fueled by drugs. or drug crimes. And so alcohol also plays a role in a lot of those instances. And so you can't just, if you focus too much on one area, it's like a pop-a-mole, right? You're going to see an increase in other areas. I really am in a really good spot as the Attorney General. I feel bad for some of my counterparts in the other states, because in order to get like a cohesive plan in their states, they have to convince a bunch of DAs that are elected to all wrap their arms around a issue in a similar way. But that doesn't occur in Alaska. And I think that's a big benefit to the state.
And sticking with you for a minute, as you noted, sadly, we lead the nation in these terrible rates of violence against women. You had mentioned that some people have misconceptions about where the violence takes place in our state. They think that because many rural communities lack local police, that the rates must be higher in rural Alaska. But you said that's not the case, that the numbers are about the same in urban Alaska. How does this affect how you approach thinking about lowering these rates across the state and the resources you bring to that?
No, Laurie, I appreciate that question. Before I get into that question, I think we should talk about where we are rate-wise first. You know, so I think we're at about 40-year lows for crime rates in the state of Alaska. Violent crime is down 4.9% in the most recent statistical year. Sexual assaults in that same year are down 15.7%. That's a 25% total reduction in sexual assault since 2018. So I think we're on the right track. And I think we could point to several different things that the legislature did to help us get there. Those are hopeful numbers. We're still not where we want to be, but that's a hopeful trend that continues. As far as the urban-rural thing, I think a lot of people have the misconception that a lot of these things are rural-related. Like if you live in Anchorage or Fairbanks, you're like, oh yeah, that's out in the bush, when you hear these horrible crime statistics that we have. And the truth is, when you look at, like, say we just look at sexual assaults, for example. Now, Western Alaska has extremely high rates of sex assault, but so does Anchorage, the Bull, mm-hmm. Anchorage Bull. Both of those are way above state averages. But then you look at like South Central Alaska, which is fairly rural, or South Central, excluding Anchorage, right? Yeah. And then the Northern Alaska, for example, they're way below average on sex assaults. And so it doesn't really seem to correlate to whether you live in a rural area or an urban area. It just seems we see those trends pop up in certain areas, and then you got to figure out why, or you've got to start cracking down or aggressively prosecute more of those cases.
And you mentioned the troopers report. There was an annual report from 2023 that showed rates of violence had dropped 25% since 2018. Are you concerned that, I mean, is this law enforcement? Is this a societal shift, or is it possible that people are afraid to report these?
Yeah,
groups?
No, that is an area that I think about quite a bit. Right. We hope that it's our efforts that are reducing those. But like I said, they're good trends and we'll keep following those. But I don't think it's time for us to slap ourselves on the back and say that we're doing a good job, because you're very well right. We don't know whether this is because people are no longer reporting these mm-hmm. crimes. Right. They feel so hopeless with the system that they're no longer reporting those crimes. And that would be devastating, right? And that would, we want the trends, we want the percentages to go down, but we don't want the percentages to go down because people aren't reporting the crimes. And so those are things that we're going to have to monitor and we're going to have to pay attention to, because obviously when you get into this job or you become a prosecutor, become the U.S. attorney, the last thing you want is crime to increase or people to feel not comfortable with the system in order to report crime. And so those things I do think about quite a bit.
Thank you. U.S. Attorney Heyman, let's talk about how drugs are getting here. We know they come through the mail on vessels, planes, cargo, by car across the Canadian border. What are the major routes that you're identifying? I've heard it sometimes that the common route is airline passengers smuggling them on board. Where are the main entry points that you're finding?
Drug traffickers are creative. There's no doubt about that. They have a financial incentive to come up with a number of different ways. But we have identified two primary ways that narcotics are making their way into the state, and you've stated them, which is airplanes, including passengers, and mail parcel service. And there's no statistic that we could possibly say, oh, it's 90% or 95%. Mm-hmm. But in our experience, the vast majority is coming through one of those two ways. And so what we've done, and again, this comes back to Operation Take Back America, is we say, okay, we recognize that these are the two primary ways that the drugs are getting here, and so we're laser focused on how we stop that and how we interdict as much as possible. And what we've done is we've come up with, for instance, a parcel initiative where we're working with our state partners, where they're actually putting troopers within the Postal Service to work these parcel cases. And so I was actually at the post office down by the airport the other day looking at this how we track packages that are coming in. We're using dogs. We're using other tracking devices to figure out things that are inconsistent with the parcel so that we can identify them, pull them out, potentially get a warrant. And just since January of this year, for instance, we've already seized about 8 kilos of fentanyl alone at our postal service at the airport, which is enough to kill, you know, the population of Alaska many times over.
And the president got mad at Canada and said, hey, stop the flow of fentanyl or you're going to get more tariffs. How do you see the amount of that part of the problem? How much is coming across the Canadian border?
We are not seeing that as a primary place where narcotics are entering Alaska. I can't speak to whether that's happening in the lower 48, but as far as Alaska is concerned, it's those two ways that I talked about.
All right. Attorney General Taylor, the Department of Law is prosecuting accused rapists after getting more money to process the backlog of sexual assault kits. Describe what you're able to do in that regard and how that may relate to people being hesitant about reporting, and maybe that will change things going forward.
Yeah, Lori. We identified when the new administration came in that we had a backlog of about 3,000 sex assault tests that had not been processed. And that was all different law enforcement agencies across all of the state. And so we made a concerted effort. We spent state money. We got federal money to help us process those in a timely manner. And as a result of that, we have been able to prosecute 9 individuals for sex assault, a couple from all the way back to 1995, and then one from 2001 as well. So that's promising. And that puts all that information into the database that we all rely on for trying to find out who the perpetrator was, right? And so I think that also sends a message to the population, right, that we are taking this very seriously, and we are we're trying to be more victim oriented in these cases, be supportive, provide support services to the victims, because the last thing, as we discussed just a little while ago, the last thing you want is for people to feel so hopeless and without help that they simply don't report these things. And so sometimes those kits weren't processed for various reasons. Either the victim decided they didn't want to move forward, or there's all kinds of reasons why that occurs. And it's not just, you know, that they just didn't get around to testing them. There's real reasons why those didn't get processed. But we made that concerted effort is paying dividends, and probably will continue to pay dividends as far as holding those accountable who've perpetrated these horrible crimes.
Crimes against children is another area of big concern in Alaska. Talk about how your office, Attorney General Taylor, works with local, tribal, federal authorities on these child in need of aid cases.
Yeah, so child in need of aid is on the civil side. So that's when you think of Office of Children's Services. Mm-hmm. Those are the individuals, those caseworkers bring cases forward, and we're the attorneys for the state on those cases. And so the idea is the state is tasked with representing the safety of the children in those cases and trying to make sure that they're in the safest environment that they can be in. And oftentimes, as we know, that means removing those children temporarily or permanently from homes. And so that is the biggest section that we have in the civil side. So the way that the breakdown of the attorneys in the Department of Law, there's about 150 prosecutors and there's about 150 attorneys on the civil side. And the biggest bulk, the section of that has the largest numbers is that section, the China section, because we are focused on that aspect of it. And there's just a large need in Alaska for that. And it's an unfortunate thing. And we're doing things to try to reduce those. We're entering into contracts with tribes to provide services in those instances. So they were calling them compacting with the tribes to help where they can get to the point where they can adjudicate those types of cases within the tribe. There's all kinds of things we're trying to do to reduce that. We're always going to have that children that are going to be in need of aid of help. That's probably never going to end, unfortunately. But I do, my hat goes off to the caseworkers at OCS that deal with these cases and to the attorneys that help prosecute these cases, because it's hard work and it's a thankless work at times. And so I do, my hat goes off to them.
Is there anything in this new partnering between state and federal law enforcement? I know this is a civil area of law, but are there times that there are federal avenues when it relates to children's needs in this way?
When it comes to exploitation that falls on the criminal side, the answer is absolutely. If it is purely a civil issue, that's going to be Attorney General Taylor's office. But this comes back to that renewed focus and collaboration that we've been referring to, is once it may cross over into that criminal world, the two of us are going to be working hand in hand to figure out what the best avenue is to address that problem. And here's an example, is the state and our partners at the DA's office are the experts in sort of the exploitation of children and child sexual assault on a child. That is a state crime that they are best equipped to handle. When you take that same perpetrator that's gone then on the internet and starts to transmit photos of a child across the internet, that's where the federal government can come in. And so we will look at a case and figure out what the facts are to determine which office is best suited to attack that particular case. But that's why that collaboration is so important, is because if the federal government simply comes in and thinks that it can handle the case, it may be missing a critical component that the state is better equipped to handle, and vice versa.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We are going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion about how the state's Attorney General, Treg Taylor, and the state's U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman, are working together to stop the flow of drugs into Alaska as Talk of Alaska continues statewide. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. Today in the studio with me is Alaska's Attorney General, Treg Taylor, and also the U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman, is in the studio with us today. We're talking about the Take America Back anti-drug campaign that started earlier this spring and is bringing more federal resources to Alaska to stop or try to stop the flow of illegal drugs into our state. We know fentanyl is deadly. There's the One Pill Can Kill campaign to raise awareness about how lethal it is. And now there is a drug called carfentanil. Perhaps it's been around a lot longer than I realize, but that is not a name that I was familiar with. But apparently it's even worse. Please, both of you, describe what this is for those of us who are unfamiliar with this drug.
Yeah, go ahead, Mike.
Okay. Let's start with a little bit of background on fentanyl. And I know I'm going to venture a guess that the vast majority of your listeners have heard of fentanyl. And we sort of, you know, we all appreciate how dangerous it is. But on the other hand, I don't think it's necessarily in our brains how just ridiculously dangerous it is. And what I mean by that is, you know, the example I used to like to use is a packet of sugar. Like if you think just a packet, when you go to McDonald's or wherever and you can open up a little satchel of sugar, that's enough potency to kill 500 people in that one little packet. So then
it's just astounding.
It is. It's mind-boggling how it could be so powerful. And then let's take the next leap, which is carfentanil, which is 100 times more powerful than even the fentanyl that I just described. And so it's of a magnitude that we've not seen before. Carfentanil has been in the lower 48 for a number of years, but unfortunately, Alaska, you know, we sometimes lag behind the lower 48, and now it's been introduced into Alaska. The extent to which it's been introduced is unclear at this point, but we have already now charged, at least on the federal side, our first carfentanil overdose case, and we intend to pursue those cases extremely aggressively because it is so powerful. And the tragedy all of it is, a lot of times, the people that are that are trafficking in this carfentanil don't even necessarily know it, because the stuff is making its way up from the lower 48. It's being produced by the cartels. It's cheap. It's ridiculously powerful. And it ends up on our streets when people don't even necessarily know it. So we're going to have to tackle not only the fact that it's here, but it's how do we then charge people that don't necessarily know that that's the particular substance that they're putting out to our communities.
The man that was charged, the dealer that was charged for giving a teenager carfentanil, the teenager died. Sean Mobley, I believe his name was.
Yeah, from the Valley.
Describe how those charges are or could increase for selling carfentanil. And is that related to this new campaign or designating drug dealers, cartels as terrorists? How do the charges change now in a case like this?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. We recently worked with the legislature, passed legislation that increased the penalties for drug dealers who deal drugs that result in the death of the individuals. And so basically what used to be was that penalty was manslaughter. We've increased that penalty to second-degree murder. And so that is going to be a big tool for us as we fight that. It's one of those things, too, that's hard to – it's a hard thing to prove in court when you have to – the level of burden on the state to prove the relationship between the overdose and that dealer. And so this is just an added tool for us to utilize in the prosecution of those, and then also in the ability we have to plea out some of those cases.
And could this be a threshold, sort of a new threshold for charging dealers with murder whenever there are overdose deaths?
You know, that's exactly what it's designed to do. And we're, you know, if I knew all the addresses, I'd send them all an address and say, hey, you're liable for second degree murder now for what you're doing if it results in the death. I hope that they're aware. I'm sure the word's gotten around on the street that there's an increased sentence for that. And so the idea is hopefully it has an impact there, lesser people selling. That's probably a little naive, but it does give us a lot better tools in order to charge those individuals and see results.
Did you want to add?
This is so important because when we talk about Operation Take Back America, this is one of the tools that we have as prosecutors on the federal side to address these fentanyl and carfentanil issues. And you talked about Mobley. I can't speak to that particular case because it is an ongoing criminal case. But I do want to address one of the tools here, which is mandatory minimums. Up until February of this year, the U.S. Attorney's Office had to get special permission, for instance, to charge a case that carried with it a mandatory minimum sentence, 10 years for a certain amount of drugs, or if there's a death resulting, 20 years. Okay, that policy has completely flipped on its head. And again, one of the tools that we now have that we can charge all of these cases, if there's a death resulting, we can charge them with a 20-year mandatory case. And we are required to charge that mandatory minimum case now, which is totally different than it was before. In addition, these cases, if it's a death resulting, are now death penalty eligible. And so we will be looking at every one of our cases where there's a death resulting and determining whether it meets the criteria to warrant us seeking the death penalty on those cases, something that just did not exist previously.
Quite serious and definitely an increase in penalty for those who commit those crimes. Let's go to the phones for a moment. Michael is in Homer. Hello, Michael.
Yeah, hello. Thanks for being on the show. I know this is an important issue to many of us in these communities, especially from my perspective on the Lower Peninsula. We see a wave of property crimes and obvious methamphetamine and fentanyl activity around us all the time. It's affecting families. It's affecting the economy. It's definitely affecting children. We also see a rotating or revolving door philosophy that appears to be happening in our courts, where these property crimes with obvious drug activity will be immediately released with summons on some occasions, and then perhaps arrested the very next day, breaking into the same property where they were caught the day before. We saw that happen in Soldotna last week. Is this a problem with policy? Is this a problem with legislation? Is this a problem with funding or will? And how do we, together with you guys, start to really crack down with meaningful sentencing and possible reforms to attack and listen to the people and attack these problems head on and with some finality?
Yeah, I go ahead. And
thank
that
you,
seems
Michael.
To be a bit of a state question there, and I'll take that head on. Yeah, we saw that issue, and so we actually passed legislation in 2019 to try to address some of these reoccurring issues and people getting out on bail and then the next day committing the same crime and then repeating that over and over and over again. Because as law enforcement, that's extremely frustrating for us too. That's the last result we want to see. We want to put bad guys in jail and hold them accountable for their crimes and impart justice in a way that is going to be accessible to everyone. And so in 2019, we repealed SB 91. And I don't know if you remember that. There's just a rash of car thefts around Anchorage and around Alaska in general, and these same individuals would be back on the street. So we tried this more progressive model of sentencing and bail schedules, and that didn't work. Clearly, we saw an uptick in all these types of crimes. And so we with the work of the legislature in 2019, repealed SB 91. And we've seen great results from it. It's not perfect yet. And I think some of those old habits still persist within the courts as far as the types of bail that occurs in the types of the situations when people are let back out on the street. And so, again, that's something that we don't want to see as prosecutors. It's something we argue about with the defendant's attorney as far as allowing that to occur. And so that's not a result that we like to see. But we have seen some successes. We talked about Haida, for example, before, where we've really targeted certain areas. And maybe Kenai's on that list. I won't divulge anything, but maybe Kenai's on that list. But in May, we targeted the Matsu Valley, and there was 41 arrests made in a two-day period. In July, we targeted Anchorage, and there was over 100 arrests made in Anchorage. So we're trying to get there. Again, we don't have unlimited resources, so we're dealing with what manpower we have as far as the number of officers, the number of prosecutors that are able to hit these on, and also we have to balance magnitude of crime, right? So obviously, if there's a murder and there's a drug deal taking place, our focus is going to be on that murder. It's just human nature, and it's how it probably should be, Bill, because neither of us in our offices have unlimited resources to address them both. But no, I hear your concern. It is a concern to us as well, and it's something that we're trying to address.
Mr. Heyman.
I have a couple things I'd like to throw in there as well. I'm a parent. I'm a community member, and just recently, for instance, I bought my son a new bike, shiny new bike, and it got stolen out in front of my house. And so to have that conversation with my child to explain, you're not getting your bike back, unfortunately. And it can be disheartening as a community member. The one takeaway, though, that I told my son is, well, we may not be getting your bike back, but we can help address this issue, and we need to file our police report. So we did. We had the police officer come out. He was a gentleman, took all of our information, because those pieces of information are what our local partners and our federal law enforcement need to start building cases, right? We want to be aggressive. We will be aggressive, but we have to do it responsibly, meaning we have to do the right thing and build up a case that's provable in court. So I do want to emphasize that even folks that think that law enforcement isn't listening, you don't see action, giving those tips help us build up the arsenal of information in order to make those cases. And, to some degree, we've actually had pretty darn good success so far with Operation Take Back America. We've already charged 39 defendants, right? This is just within the last few months. 39 different people with a lot of these drug trafficking offenses, a lot of which are built based on the good work that the troopers and local law enforcement are doing, coupled with the tips. And when you think about those 39 defendants and the volume of drugs that we've taken off the street just in the last 5 months is incredible. And so with the continued tips and the continued collaboration, we're going to continue that forward.
All right. We are going to take another short break. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion with the state's Attorney General, Treg Taylor, and the state's U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman, as we discuss the Take Back America anti-drug campaign as Talk of Alaska continues. Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. We have today in the studio Alaska's Attorney General, Treg Taylor, and the U.S. Attorney for Alaska, Michael Heyman. They're both in studio today talking about the Take Back America anti-drug campaign. Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Sandra is in Talkeetna. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is for both gentlemen, and I'd basically like to thank you for your efforts in trying to keep a lot of drugs out of Alaska. Appreciate it. But I also wonder, just because of your point of view and the positions of authority that you have in this area, what your thoughts are on the efforts to reduce demand. Because it seems as if as long as there's demand, you can, conduct the war forever, but there will always be someone trying to seek that money from that demand that exists. And I've read about a couple of programs in the international community, like in the Scandinavian countries, providing safe housing and support for people that are trying to recover from use. And just what you think about any programs you think would be effective for reducing the demand for drugs.
Thank you so much, Sandra, for that that question. It kind of goes hand in hand with an email question that we had about programs from David in Fairbanks. David writes, discrimination and harassment against LGBT people leads to isolation and depression, which causes higher rates of drug use and abuse. So again, that demand. Does Alaska have any statewide programs to address the social causes of drug use? And he's asking specifically for the LGBT community, but Sandra's, talking in a broad sense about how can we approach that side of it? If there isn't demand, then the problem wouldn't be so big.
No, you're absolutely right. And that's a great question and something that I can address as the Attorney General. We do have funds available to start develop those programs, whether there's programs already existing that are going to be beefed up or whether we look at what's going on, like you mentioned, in other states, looking at models that work and when you do the math, they're actually making a difference. I teamed up with the attorneys general and a lot of other states to go after some of the pharmaceutical manufacturers of opioids and also the distributors of those opioids for sort of misleading doctors, misleading the public about the addictive properties of those opioids, and we were very successful. So we were able to get over $100 million for the state of Alaska through that litigation. And also, a lot of the local communities will also be in funds from that litigation. So the state will have additional funds in the form of that $100 million over the next several years. That's not a lump sum, but it'll be coming in over the next 5 to 10 years, depending on the settlement that we entered in with those opioid manufacturers. And so we should be able to use those. And so we have a body under those settlements. We have a body within the state created to look to how we best use those funds. And so we have people from various agencies that are on that body that are going to be making those decisions. But I look forward to having a more robust program for them, because you're absolutely right. If you're not addressing the underlying issue, and some of these people, innocently enough, are addicted to these things, right? They go in for a broken ankle, and for whatever reason, that opioid pull is just stronger in some individuals than others. Those programs, I hope, will go a long way to providing the resources that these individuals need to recover from these addictions. And those addictions, by the way, lead to crime, right? You have tales of perfectly capable people with good jobs that are adding to society, and they do. They go in for that surgery, they become addicted. Pretty soon they're stealing from their brother-in-law's cabinet, and then when that runs out, they're stealing from homes in order to sell things in order to buy drugs on the street to feed that addiction. And so it is a big issue and something that we're focused on.
And that settlement money is aimed pretty much directly at those types of programs of support?
100% for treatment.
All right.
Yep.
For both of you, under the first Trump administration, U.S. Attorney General William Barr came to Alaska, declared the lack of law enforcement in rural Alaska an emergency, and committed millions of dollars to it. Talk about what that triggered and how much has it helped on both the state and federal law enforcement side since that time.
It's helped in a number of ways. And what it did start was drawing the attention that rural Alaska needed. And never before had we seen that kind of attention being given to the problems that are facing our rural communities. Then it started a cascade of events. In legislation, for instance, we have the Violence Against Women Reauthorization Act of 2020. We have Savannah's Act. We have a number of these pieces of legislation that have then created a framework that we can start to address these issues rather than just, you know, haphazard, ad hoc addressing, an issue as it comes up now and again. These pieces of legislation allowed us to put together that framework. And here's a couple of examples is in the Savannah's Act and Violence Against Women Act, we've been empowering our local communities to deal with some of these issues. We are now working with our tribal partners on a regular basis. We have I can't tell you how many meetings we have with these partners to start talking about the best way to approach them. And they've put together tribal community response plans, for instance. And we have now four communities that actually have these formalized documents that triggers a chain of events when someone goes missing in our rural communities, right? And so if someone goes missing before, you know, what do? Maybe you call 911. You don't know the exact steps on what resources are available and how do you tap into them. So these tribal community response plans have formalized the process that our communities can go through when someone goes missing or there's been a domestic violence issue that's occurred.
Right.
Yeah, and I can add to that too. So under when Barr came and he provided that additional funding, he provided it to the Department of Law specifically to prosecutor positions and one paralegal position. And we have focused that on rural prosecution of sex crimes. This group is active. They're some of our superstars in our prosecutor team. In 2024, example, alone in 2024, they prosecuted 135 individuals, 51 for sex felonies, and 21 for homicides. So this is a very active team. And unfortunately, the federal funding ran out for the state on those positions, but we were able to get state funding to keep those positions in place because of how effective they've been.
All right. That sounds like a good success.
And I'll add on to that is within my office, we have three prosecutors that have been tasked with rural outreach and rural law enforcement. And just since February of this year, you know, I did some research before we came on today to start looking at what specific type of cases, right? We want to put some meat on the bones. And so I was curious as to the actual cases that we have prosecuted in rural Alaska and where those have come from. And so we have everything from, you know, straight drug trafficking of fentanyl, dozens and dozens of people that have been prosecuted just this year alone, some resulting in death. We have a case where there's been a tremendous amount of tramadol, you know, not a drug that you necessarily hear about, but, you know, again, they're finding creative ways to put this poison on our communities to make money. But we also have, for instance, one case where there was a federal assault on an officer. We have child exploitation cases that are originating in our rural communities because of this emphasis and direction of resources to rural Alaska.
Let's go back to the phones for a moment. Kurt is in Sitka in our final minutes here in the program. Kurt, are you still there?
Yes, hi.
Hello.
Yes, I just had a quick question. And maybe this was already previously covered, but the whole... I'm assuming because of the extremely small amounts of the fentanyl and the carfentanil needed to be lethal, it doesn't seem to make a lot of financial sense. I mean, what's the business model behind that if such a small amount can easily kill your user? I mean, we know nicotine kills, but cigarettes take, you know, decades and decades, and the companies have made lots of money off you. How is the money being made off of getting the fentanyl into the drugs? It doesn't seem to make sense.
Yeah, U.S. Attorney Heyman talked about a little bit about that, and I'll add some depth to what he was talking about. Most people aren't out there looking to buy fentanyl. Most people are out there to buy opioid or some other drug, right? There some pills that are normally prescribed that are now on the street, and so they're looking to buy those types of drugs. So the business sense for why fentanyl is important to the cartels is because they can put fentanyl in a pill that is supposed to be something other other substance entirely, right? And so these buyers are unknowingly taking fentanyl. That's what makes fentanyl so dangerous, because A, it takes so little to kill, and B, most of the people using it don't know they're using it. And so instead of paying for expensive, what is normally be an opioid pill that's prescribed in hospitals, instead of paying street value for that, they can introduce a little bit of fentanyl into that and give it the result that the person's looking for when they purchase it, but half at really low costs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is such a great question, because I scratch my head all the time wondering how this business model makes any sense if you're killing your end user. And I think the short answer to that, as we touched upon briefly, but you know, when you think about it, the cost of this fentanyl is so cheap and the impact is so heavy, like the hallucinogenic impacts are so great that all you need to do is produce a little bit of it and get it into other materials, as we were talking about, that it actually, the business model does make sense for the cartels.
Well, we've talked a lot about fentanyl, and we only have about a minute or so left. I have so many questions. But methamphetamines and heroin are also very addictive, very dangerous. Over half of Alaska's fatal overdoses since 2017 have involved meth. How much of the meth is made in the United States, and are some of the pipelines of fentanyl and other dangerous drugs like heroin and opioids being manufactured in the U.S.? What do we know about that?
The methamphetamine, if we go back over 20 years ago, was primarily being manufactured in the U.S., but we've actually successfully cracked down, for the most part, on our local meth manufacturers. It's not to say that it doesn't still exist, but you know, we've all gone to the Walgreens or CVS, and you see that the Sudafed, for instance, is behind closed counters. And so it's pushed the production down to Mexico, where it's extremely cheap. So the vast majority of the methamphetamine that's entering the streets of Alaska is coming from Mexico.
Okay. All right. And there have been some legislative help to prosecute sexual assault. Remind us of what the legislature changed about consent law. And did they also increase the penalty in that same setting for overdose deaths?
Yeah.
We talked a little about that.
Yeah,
earlier.
So two different pieces of legislation.
Right.
I can talk a little bit about the consent law. I believe that was passed by the legislature in 2022. And the gist of consent law is that no really means no. And above that, you need affirmative consent from your partner. That is a tool that'll help law enforcement as they prosecute these cases. The level of I guess the affirmative part of that helps us in those cases when one party's claiming consensual and the other party's not.
Mm-hmm. Where do you want folks? We only have a few, just about 30 seconds left here. Where should folks go for more information? Where do you want them to go to find out more about this?
There's a variety of places. You can always call our office. We have a public relations individual who addresses these kind of concerns. A lot of times we will then also talk with our state partners, because they are the local experts on the ground to find out more information.
All right. We'll try to put some links on our website with the Talk of Alaska Post. Thank you so much to my guest today, Alaska's Attorney General Treg Taylor and U.S. Attorney for Alaska Michael Heyman in the studio with us. Our thanks to our engineering team, Chris Hyde, our producer, Madeline Rose. Liz Ruskin edited today's show, and on the phones, Eliza Dunn helped us out. I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks for listening. We'll be back next week.
Talk of Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.